are clearly perceived, so the appropriate rate at which the future should be discounted is never certain. Thus, market prices must always be wrong to some extent. But at any particular time, it is not obvious to anyone whether they are too high or too low. The evidence I will present next shows that professional investors are not able to adjust their portfolios so that they hold only undervalued stocks and avoid overvalued ones. The fact that the best and the brightest on Wall Street cannot consistently distinguish correct valuations from incorrect ones shows how hard it is to beat the market. There is no evidence that anyone can generate excess returns by making consistently correct bets against the collective wisdom of the market. Markets are not always or even usually correct, but no one person or institution consistently knows more than the market. Nor does the unprecedented bubble and bust in house prices during the first decade of the 2000s drive a stake through the heart of the efficient market hypothesis. If individuals are given an opportunity to buy houses with no money down, it can be the height of rationality to be willing to pay an inflated price. If the house continues to escalate in value, the buyer will profit. If the bubble bursts and the house price declines, the buyer walks away and leaves the lender, and perhaps ultimately the government, with a loss. Yes, the incentives were perverse. And in retrospect, regulation was lax and some government policies were ill-considered. But in no sense was this sorry episode and the deep recession that followed caused by a blind faith in the efficient market hypothesis. Part 2. How the Pros Play the Biggest Game in Town. Chapter 5. Technical and Fundamental Analysis. From an old Chinese proverb, a picture is worth 10,000 words. From La Rochefoucauld, Réflexion ou sentence et maxime morale. The greatest of all gifts is the power to estimate things at their true worth. On a typical trading day, shares with a total market value of hundreds of billions are traded on the New York Stock Exchange, the Nasdaq market, and various electronic crossing networks across the country. Including markets for futures, options, and swaps, trillions of dollars of transactions take place each day. Professional investment analysts and counselors are involved in what has been called the biggest game in town. If the stakes are high, so are the rewards. When Wall Street is having a good year, new trainees from the Harvard Business School routinely draw salaries of $200,000 per year. At the top of the salary scale are the high-profile money managers themselves, the men and women who run the large mutual and pension funds and who manage the trillions of dollars of hedge fund and private equity assets. Adam Smith, after writing The Money Game, boasted that he would make $250,000 from his best-selling book. His Wall Street friends retorted, "You're only going to make as much as a second-rate institutional salesman." Although not the oldest, the profession of high finance is certainly one of the most generously compensated. Part 2 of this book concentrates on the methods used by professional portfolio managers. It shows how academics have analyzed their investment results and have concluded that they are not worth the money you pay for them. It then introduces the efficient market hypothesis, EMH, and its practical implication. Stock investors can do no better than simply buying and holding an index fund that owns a portfolio consisting of all the stocks in the market. Technical versus fundamental analysis. The attempt to predict accurately the future course of stock prices and thus the appropriate time to buy or sell a stock must rank as one of investors' most persistent endeavors. This search for the golden egg has spawned a variety of methods, ranging from the scientific to the occult. There are people today who forecast future stock prices by measuring sunspots, looking at the phases of the moon, or measuring the vibrations along the San Andreas Fault. Most, however, opt for one of two methods, technical or fundamental analysis. The alternative techniques used by the investment pros are related to the two theories of the stock market I covered in Part 1. Technical analysis is the method of predicting the appropriate time to buy or sell a stock used by those believing in the castle-in-the-air view of stock pricing. Fundamental analysis is the technique of applying the tenets of the firm foundation theory to the selection of individual stocks. Technical analysis is essentially the making and interpreting of stock charts. Thus, its practitioners, a small but abnormally dedicated cult, are called chartists or technicians. They study the past, both the movements of common stock prices and the volume of trading, for a clue to the direction of future change. Many chartists believe that the market is only 10% logical and 90% psychological. They generally subscribe to the castle-in-the-air school and view the investment game as one of anticipating how the other players will behave. Charts, of course, tell only what the other players have been doing in the past. The chartists' hope, however, is that a careful study of what the other players are doing will shed light on what the crowd is likely to do in the future. Fundamental analysts take the opposite tack, believing that the market is 90% logical and only 10% psychological. Caring little about the particular pattern of past price movements, fundamentalists seek to determine a stock's proper value. Value in this case is related to a company's assets, its expected growth rate of earnings and dividends, interest rates, and risk. By studying these factors, the fundamentalist arrives at an estimate of a security's intrinsic value or firm foundation of value. If this is above the market price, then the investor is advised to buy. Fundamentalists believe that eventually the market will reflect the security's real worth. Perhaps 90% of the Wall Street security analysts consider themselves fundamentalists. Many would argue that chartists are lacking in dignity and professionalism. What can charts tell you? The first principle of technical analysis is that all information about earnings, dividends, and the future performance of a company is automatically reflected in the company's past market prices. A chart showing these prices and the volume of trading already comprises all the fundamental information, good or bad, that the security analyst can hope to know. The second principle is that prices tend to move in trends. A stock that is rising tends to keep on rising, whereas a stock at rest tends to remain at rest. A true chartist doesn't even care to know what business or industry a company is in, as long as he or she can study its stock chart. A chart shaped in the form of an inverted bowl or pennant means the same for Microsoft as it does for Coca-Cola. Fundamental information on earnings and dividends is considered at best to be useless, and at worst, a positive distraction. It is either of inconsequential importance for the pricing of the stock, or, if it is important, it has already been reflected in the market days, weeks, or even months in advance. Many chartists will not even read the newspaper or check the financial web services. One of the original chartists, John McGee, operated from a small office in Springfield, Massachusetts, where even the windows were boarded up to prevent any outside influences from distracting his analysis. McGee was once quoted as saying, "When I come into this office, I leave the rest of the world outside to concentrate entirely on my charts. This room is exactly the same in a blizzard as on a moonlit June evening. In here, I can't possibly do myself and my clients the disservice of saying buy simply because the sun is out or sell because it's raining." It's easy to construct a chart. Simply draw a vertical line whose bottom is the stock's low for the day and whose top is the high. This line is crossed to indicate the closing price for the day. The process can be repeated for each trading day and can be used for individual stocks or for a stock index. Often, the chartist will indicate the volume of shares of stock traded during the day by another vertical line at the bottom of the chart. Gradually, the highs and lows on the chart of the stock in question jiggle up and down sufficiently to produce patterns. To the chartist, these patterns have the same significance as X-ray plates to a surgeon. One of the first things a chartist looks for is a trend or the record of price changes for a stock over a number of days. Let's say in this example that the prices are on the way up. The chartist draws two lines connecting the tops and bottoms, creating a channel to delineate the uptrend. Because the presumption is that momentum in the market will tend to perpetuate itself, the stock can be expected to continue to rise. As McGee wrote in the Bible of Charting, Technical Analysis of Stock Trends, prices move in trends, and trends tend to continue until something happens to change the supply-demand balance. Suppose, however, that at about 24, the stock finally runs into trouble and is unable to gain any further ground. This is called a resistance level. The stock may wiggle around a bit and then turn downward. One pattern which Chartists claim reveals a clear signal that the market has topped out is a head-and-shoulders formation. The stock first rises and then falls slightly, forming a rounded shoulder. It rises again, going slightly higher, before once more receding, forming a head. Finally, the right shoulder is formed, and Chartists wait with bated breath for the sell signal, which sounds loud and clear when the stock pierces the neckline. With the glee of Count Dracula surveying one of his victims, the Chartists are off and selling, anticipating that a prolonged downtrend will follow, as it allegedly has in the past. Of course, sometimes the market surprises the Chartist. For example, the stock may make an end run up to 30 right after giving a bear signal. This is called a bear trap, or, to the Chartist, the exception that tests the rule. It follows from the technique that the Chartist is a trader, not a long-term investor. The Chartist buys when the auguries look favorable and sells on bad omens. He flirts with stocks just as some flirt with the opposite sex, and his scores are successful in-and-out trades, not rewarding long-term commitments. Indeed, the psychiatrist Don D. Jackson, author with Albert Haas, Jr. of Bulls, Bears, and Dr. Freud, suggested that such an individual may be playing a game with overt sexual overtones. When the Chartist chooses a stock, there is typically a period of observation and flirtation before he commits himself, because for the Chartist, as in romance and sexual conquest, timing is essential. There is mounting excitement as the stock penetrates the base formation and rises higher. Finally, if the affair has gone well, there is the moment of fulfillment, profit-taking, and the release and afterglow that follow. The Chartist's vocabulary features such terms as double bottoms, breakthrough, violating the lows, firmed up, big play, ascending peaks, and buying climax. And all this takes place under the pennant of that great symbol of sexuality, the bull. The rationale for the charting method. Why is charting supposed to work? Many chartists freely admit that they don't know why charting should work. History just has a habit of repeating itself. To me, the following three explanations of technical analysis appear to be the most plausible. First, it has been argued that the crowd instinct of mass psychology makes trends perpetuate themselves. When investors see the price of a speculative favorite going higher and higher, they want to jump on the bandwagon and join the rise. Indeed, the price rise itself helps fuel the enthusiasm in a self-fulfilling prophecy. Each rise in price just whets the appetite and makes investors expect a further rise. Second, there may be unequal access to fundamental information about a company. When some favorable piece of news occurs, such as the discovery of a rich mineral deposit, it is alleged that the insiders are the first to know, and they act, buying the stock and causing its price to rise. The insiders then tell their friends, who act next. Then, the professionals find out the news, and the big institutions put blocks of the shares in their portfolios. Finally, the poor slobs like you and me get the information and buy, pushing the price still higher. This process is supposed to result in a rather gradual increase in the price of the stock when the news is good and a decrease when the news is bad. Third, investors often underreact initially to new information. There is some evidence that when earnings are announced that beat or trail Wall Street estimates, positive or negative earnings surprises, the stock price reacts positively, negatively, but the initial adjustment is incomplete. Thus, the stock market will often adjust to earnings information only gradually, resulting in a sustained period of price momentum. Chartists also believe that people have a nasty habit of remembering what they paid for a stock or the price they wish they had paid. For example, suppose a stock sold for about $50 a share for a long period of time, during which a number of investors bought in. Suppose then that the price drops to $40. The Chartists claim that the public will be anxious to sell out the shares when they rise back to the price at which they were bought, and thus break even on the trade. Consequently, the price at $50, at which the stock sold initially, becomes a resistance area. Each time the resistance area is reached and the stock turns down, the resistance level becomes harder to cross, because more investors get the idea that the market or the individual stock in question cannot go any higher. A similar argument lies behind the notion of support levels. Chartists say that many investors who failed to buy when the market fluctuated around a relatively low price level will feel they have missed the boat when prices rise. Presumably, such investors will jump at the chance to buy when prices drop back to the original low level. In chart theory, a support area that holds on successive declines becomes stronger and stronger. So, if a stock declines to a support area and then begins to rise, the traders will jump in, believing that the stock is just coming off the pad. Another bullish signal is flashed when a stock finally breaks through a resistance area. In the lexicon of the Chartists, the former resistance area becomes a support area, and the stock should have no trouble gaining further ground. Why might charting fail to work? There are many logical arguments against charting. First, note that the Chartist buys only after price trends have been established, and sells only after they have been broken. Because sharp reversals in the market may occur quite suddenly, the Chartist often misses the boat. By the time an uptrend is signaled, it may already have taken place. Second, such techniques must ultimately be self-defeating. As more and more people use it, the value of any technique depreciates. No buy or sell signal can be worthwhile if everyone tries to act on it simultaneously. Moreover, traders tend to anticipate technical signals. If they see a price about to break through a resistance area, they tend to buy before, not after, it breaks through. This suggests that others will try to anticipate the signal still earlier. Of course, the earlier they anticipate, the less certain they are that the signal will occur and that the trade will be profitable. Perhaps the most telling argument against technical methods comes from the logical implications of profit-maximizing behavior. Suppose that Universal Polymers is selling at around 20 when Sam, the chief research chemist, discovers a new production technique that promises to double the company's earnings. Sam is convinced that the price of Universal will hit 40 when the news of his discovery comes out. Because any purchases below 40 will provide a swift profit, he may well buy up all the stock he can until the price hits 40, a process that could take no longer than a few minutes. Even if Sam doesn't have enough money to drive up the price himself, surely his friends and professional traders do have the funds to move the price so rapidly that no Chartist could get into the act before the whole play is gone. The market may well be a most efficient mechanism. If some people know that the price will go to 40 tomorrow, it will go to 40 today. From Chartist to Technician. Although Chartists are not held in high repute on Wall Street, their colorful methods have attracted a wide following. The companies that distribute stock charts, the computer programmers who provide charting software, and financial news networks such as CNBC and Bloomberg have enjoyed a boom in their sales, and Chartists themselves still find excellent employment opportunities with brokerage firms. In the days before the computer, the laborious task of charting a course through the market was done by hand. Chartists were often viewed as peculiar people with green eye shades who were tucked away in a small closet at the back of the office. Now Chartists have computer services hooked into a variety of data networks and replete with a large display terminal that, at the tap of a finger, can produce every conceivable chart. The Chartist, now called a technician, can, with the glee of a child playing with a new electric train, produce a complete chart of a stock's past performance, including measures of volume, the 200-day moving average, an average of prices over the previous 200 days recalculated each day, the strength of the stock relative to the market and its industry, and literally hundreds of other averages, ratios, oscillators, and indicators. Moreover, individuals can access a variety of charts for different time periods through Internet sites such as Yahoo. The Technique of Fundamental Analysis. Fred Schwed, Jr., in his charming and witty exposé of the financial community in the 1930s, Where Are the Customer's Yachts?, tells of a Texas broker who sold some stock to a customer at $760 a share at the moment when it could have been purchased at $730. When the outraged customer found out what had happened, he complained bitterly to the broker. The Texan cut him short. "Sir," he boomed, "y'all don't appreciate the policy of this firm. This here firm selects investments for its clients not on the basis of price, but of value." In a sense, this story illustrates the difference between the technician and the fundamentalist. The technician is interested only in the record of the stock's price, whereas the fundamentalist's primary concern is with what a stock is really worth. The fundamentalist strives to be relatively immune to the optimism and pessimism of the crowd and makes a sharp distinction between a stock's current price and its true value. In estimating the firm foundation value of a stock, the fundamentalist's most important job is to estimate the firm's future stream of earnings and dividends. The worth of a share is taken to be the present or discounted value of all the cash flows the investor is expected to receive. The analyst must estimate the firm's sales level, operating costs, tax rates, depreciation, and the sources and costs of its capital requirements. Basically, the security analyst must be a prophet without the benefit of divine inspiration. As a poor substitute, the analyst turns to a study of the past record of the company, a review of the company's income statements, balance sheets, and investment plans, and a first-hand visit to and appraisal of the company's management team. The analyst must then separate the important facts from the unimportant ones. As Benjamin Graham put it in The Intelligent Investor, "Sometimes he reminds us a bit of the erudite Major General in the Pirates of Penzance with his many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse." Because the general prospects of a company are strongly influenced by the economic position of its industry, the starting point for the security analyst is a study of industry prospects. Indeed, security analysts usually specialize in particular industry groups. The fundamentalist hopes that a thorough study of industry conditions will produce valuable insights into factors that are not yet reflected in market prices. The fundamentalist uses four basic determinants to help estimate the proper value for any stock. Determinant 1. The expected growth rate. Most people don't recognize the implications of compound growth for financial decisions. Albert Einstein once described compound interest as the greatest mathematical discovery of all time. It is often said that the Native American who sold Manhattan Island in 1626 for $24 was rooked by the white man. In fact, he may have been an extremely sharp salesman. Had he put his $24 away at 6% interest, compounded semi-annually, it would now be worth more than $100 billion, and with it, his descendants could buy back much of the now improved land. Such is the magic of compound growth. Compounding is the process that makes 10 plus 10 equal 21, rather than 20. Suppose you invest $100 this year and next year in an investment that produces a 10% annual return. How much have you made by the end of year 2? If you answer 21%, then you deserve a gold star and a trip to the head of the class. The algebra is simple. Your $100 grows to $110 at the end of year 1. Next year, you also earn 10% on the $110 you start with. So you have $121 at the end of year 2. Thus, the total return over the 2-year period is 21%. The reason it works is that the interest you earn from your original investment also earns interest. Carrying it out in year 3, you have $133.10. Compounding is powerful indeed. A useful rule called the Rule of 72 provides a shortcut way to determine how long it takes for money to double. Take the interest rate you earn and divide it into the number 72, and you get the number of years it will take to double your money. For example, if the interest rate is 15%, it takes a bit less than 5 years for your money to double. 72 divided by 15 equals 4.8 years. The catch, and doesn't there always have to be at least one, if not 22, is that dividend growth does not go on forever, for the simple reason that corporations have life cycles similar to most living things. Consider the leading corporations in the United States over 100 years ago. Such names as Eastern Buggy Whip Company, La Crosse and Minnesota Steam Packet Company, Savannah and St. Paul Steamboat Line, and Hazard Powder Company would have ranked high in a Fortune Top 500 list of that era. All are now deceased. And even if the natural life cycle doesn't get a company, there's always the fact that it gets harder and harder to grow at the same percentage rate. A company earning $1 million need increase its earnings by only $100,000 to achieve a 10% growth rate, whereas a company starting from a base of $10 million in earnings needs $1 million in additional earnings to produce the same record. The nonsense of relying on very high long-term growth rates is nicely illustrated by working with population projections for the United States. If the populations of the nation and of California continue to grow at their recent rates, 120% of the United States population will live in California by the year 2045. Hazardous as projections may be, share prices must reflect differences in growth prospects if any sense is to be made of market valuations. Also, the probable length of the growth phase is very important. If one company expects to enjoy a rapid 20% growth rate for 10 years, and another growth company expects to sustain the same rate for only 5 years, the former company is, other things equal, more valuable to the investor than the latter. The point is that growth rates are general rather than gospel truths. And this brings us to the first fundamental rule for evaluating securities. Rule 1. A rational investor should be willing to pay a higher price for a share the larger the growth rate of dividends and earnings. To this is added an important corollary. Corollary to Rule 1. A rational investor should be willing to pay a higher price for a share the longer an extraordinary growth rate is expected to last. Does this rule seem to conform to actual practices? Let's first reformulate the question in terms of price earnings, P/E multiples, rather than market prices. This provides a good yardstick for comparing stocks which have different prices and earnings against one another. A stock selling at $100 per share with earnings of $10 per share would have the same P/E multiple, 10, as a stock selling at $40 with earnings of $4 per share. It is the P/E multiple, not the price, that really tells you how a stock is valued in the market. Our reformulated question now reads, are actual price earnings multiples higher for stocks for which a high growth rate is anticipated? A study by John Cragg and myself strongly indicates that the answer is yes. It was easier to collect data on prices and earnings required to calculate P/E multiples. To obtain expected long-term growth rates, we surveyed 18 leading investment firms. From each firm, we obtained estimates of the 5-year growth rates anticipated for a large sample of stocks. I will not bore you with the details of the actual statistical study that was performed. It was clear that just as Rule 1 asserts, high P/E ratios are associated with high expected growth rates. Suppose you were considering the purchase of a stock with an anticipated 8.5% growth rate, and you knew that, on average, stocks with 8.5% growth sold, like General Electric, at 18 times earnings. If the stock you were considering sold at a price-earnings multiple of 20, you might reject the idea of buying the stock in favor of one more reasonably priced in terms of current market norms. If, on the other hand, your stock sold at a multiple below the average in the market for that growth rate, the security is said to represent good value for your money. Determinant 2. The expected dividend payout. The amount of dividends you receive at each payout, as contrasted to their growth rate, is readily understandable as being an important factor in determining a stock's price. The higher the dividend payout, other things equal, the greater the value of the stock. The catch here is the phrase, other things equal. Stocks that pay out a high percentage of earnings and dividends may be poor investments if their growth prospects are unfavorable. Conversely, many companies in their most dynamic growth phase often pay no dividends. Many companies tend to buy back their shares rather than increasing their dividends. For two companies whose expected growth rates are the same, you are better off with the one that returns more cash to the shareholders. Rule 2. A rational investor should pay a higher price for a share, other things equal, the larger the proportion of a company's earnings paid out in cash dividends or used to buy back stock. Determinant 3. The degree of risk. Risk plays an important role in the stock market, no matter what your overeager broker may tell you. There is always a risk, and that's what makes the market so fascinating. Risk also affects the valuation of a stock. Some people think risk is the only aspect of a stock to be examined. The more respectable a stock is, that is, the less risk it has, the higher its quality. Stocks of the so-called blue-chip companies, for example, are said to deserve a quality premium. Why high-quality stocks are given an appellation derived from the poker tables is a fact known only to Wall Street. Most investors prefer less risky stocks, and these stocks can therefore command higher price-earnings multiples than their risky, low-quality counterparts. Although there is general agreement that the compensation for higher risk must be greater future rewards, and thus lower current prices, measuring risk is well-nigh impossible. This has not daunted the economist, however. A great deal of attention has been devoted to risk measurement by both academic economists and practitioners. According to one well-known theory, the bigger the swings, relative to the market as a whole, in an individual company stock prices, or in its total yearly returns, including dividends, the greater the risk. For example, a non-swinger such as Johnson & Johnson gets the good housekeeping seal of approval for widows and orphans. That's because its earnings are relatively stable during recessions and its dividend is secure. Therefore, when the market goes down 20%, J&J usually trails with perhaps only a 10% decline. Thus, the stock qualifies as one with less than average risk. Salesforce.com, on the other hand, has a very volatile past record, and it characteristically falls by 30% or more when the market declines by 20%. The investor gambles in owning stock in such a company, particularly if he may be forced to sell out during a time of unfavorable market conditions. When business is good and the market mounts a sustained upward drive, however, Salesforce.com can be expected to outdistance J&J. But if you are like most investors, you value stable returns over speculative hopes, freedom from worry about your portfolio over sleepless nights, and limited loss exposure over the possibility of a downhill roller coaster ride. This leads to a third basic rule of security valuation. Rule 3. A rational and risk-averse investor should pay a higher price for a share, other things equal, the less risky the company's stock. I should warn the reader that a relative volatility measure may not fully capture the relevant risk of a company. Chapter 9 will present a thorough discussion of this important risk element in stock valuation. Determinant 4. The level of market interest rates. The stock market does not exist as a world unto itself. Investors should consider how much profit they can obtain elsewhere. Interest rates, if they are high enough, can offer a stable, profitable alternative to the stock market. Consider periods such as the early 1980s, when yields on prime-quality corporate bonds soared to close to 15%. The expected returns from stock prices had trouble matching these bond rates. Money flowed into bonds while stock prices fell sharply. Finally, stock prices reached such a low level that a sufficient number of investors were attracted to stem the decline. Again, in 1987, interest rates rose substantially, preceding the great stock market crash of October 19th. To put it another way, to attract investors from high-yielding bonds, stock must offer bargain basement prices. The point can be made another way by noting that because higher interest rates enable us to earn more now, any deferred income should be discounted more heavily. Thus, the present value of any flow of future dividend returns will be lower when current interest rates are relatively high. The relationship between interest rates and stock prices is somewhat more complicated, however, than this discussion may suggest. Suppose investors expect that the rate of inflation will increase from 5% to 10%. Such an expectation is likely to drive interest rates up by about 5 percentage points to compensate investors for holding fixed dollar obligation bonds, whose purchasing power will be adversely affected by greater inflation. Other things being the same, this should make stock prices fall. But with higher expected inflation, investors may reasonably project that corporate earnings and dividends will also increase at a faster rate, causing stock prices to rise. A further discussion of inflation, interest rates, and stock prices is contained in Chapter 13. On the other hand, when interest rates are very low, fixed interest securities provide very little competition for the stock market, and stock prices tend to be relatively high. This provides justification for the last basic rule of fundamental analysis. Rule 4. A rational investor should pay a higher price for a share, other things equal, the lower the interest rates. Three important caveats. The four valuation rules imply that a security's firm foundation value and its price-earnings multiple will be higher the larger the company's growth rate and the longer its duration. The larger the dividend payout for the firm, the less risky the company's stock, and the lower the general level of interest rates. In principle, such rules are very useful in suggesting a rational basis for stock prices and in giving investors some standard of value, but before we even think of using these rules, we must bear in mind three important caveats. Caveat 1. Expectations about the future cannot be proven in the present. Predicting future earnings and dividends is a most hazardous occupation. It is extremely difficult to be objective. Wild optimism and extreme pessimism constantly battle for top place. In 2008, the economy was suffering from severe recession and a worldwide credit crisis. The best that investors could do that year was to project modest growth rates for most corporations. During the internet bubble in the late 1990s and early 2000, investors convinced themselves that a new era of high growth and unlimited prosperity was a foregone conclusion. The point to remember is that no matter what formula you use for predicting the future, it always rests in part on the indeterminate premise. Although many Wall Streeters claim to see into the future, they are just as fallible as the rest of us. As Samuel Goldwyn used to say, forecasts are difficult to make, particularly those about the future. Caveat 2. Precise figures cannot be calculated from undetermined data. It stands to reason that you can't obtain precise figures by using indefinite factors. Yet to achieve desired ends, investors and security analysts do this all the time. Take a company that you've heard lots of good things about. You study the company's prospects, and you conclude that it can maintain a high growth rate for a long period. How long? Well, why not 10 years? You then calculate what the stock should be worth on the basis of the current dividend payout, the expected future growth rate, and the general level of interest rates, perhaps making an allowance for the riskiness of the shares. It turns out, to your chagrin, that the price the stock is worth is just slightly less than its present market price. You now have two alternatives. You could regard the stock as overpriced and refuse to buy it, or you could say, perhaps this stock could maintain a high growth rate for 11 years rather than 10. After all, the 10 was only a guess in the first place, so why not 11 years? And so you go back to your computer, and lo and behold, you now come up with a worth for the shares that is larger than the current market price. Armed with this precise knowledge, you make your sound purchase. The reason the game worked is that the longer one projects extraordinary growth, the greater is the stream of future dividends. Thus, the present value of a share is at the discretion of the calculator. If 11 years was not enough to do the trick, 12 or 13 might well have sufficed. There is always some combination of growth rate and growth period that will produce any specific price. In this sense, it is intrinsically impossible to calculate the intrinsic value of a share. There is, I believe, a fundamental indeterminateness about the value of common shares, even in principle. God Almighty does not know the proper price earnings multiple for a common stock. Caveat 3. What's growth for the goose is not always growth for the gander. The difficulty comes with the value the market puts on specific fundamentals. It is always true that the market values growth and that higher growth rates and larger multiples go hand in hand. But the crucial question is, how much more should you pay for higher growth? There is no consistent answer. In some periods, as in the early 1960s and 1970s, when growth was thought to be especially desirable, the market was willing to pay an enormous price for stocks exhibiting high growth rates. At other times, such as the late 1980s and early 1990s, high growth stocks commanded only a modest premium over the multiples of common stocks in general. By early 2000, the growth stocks making up the NASDAQ 100 index sold at triple-digit price-earnings multiples. Growth can be as fashionable as tulip bulbs, as investors in growth stocks learned painfully. From a practical standpoint, the rapid changes in market valuations that have occurred suggest that it would be very dangerous to use any 1 year's valuation relationships as an indication of market norms. However, by comparing how growth stocks are currently valued with historical precedent, investors should at least be able to isolate those periods when a touch of the tulip bug has smitten investors. Why might fundamental analysis fail to work? Despite its plausibility and scientific appearance, there are three potential flaws in this type of analysis. First, the information and analysis may be incorrect. Second, the security analyst's estimate of value may be faulty. Third, the market may not correct its mistake, and the stock price may not converge to its value estimate. The security analyst studying each company and consulting with industry specialists will receive a great deal of fundamental information. Some critics have suggested that, taken as a whole, this information will be worthless. What investors make on the valid news, assuming it is not yet recognized by the market, they lose on the bad information. Moreover, the analyst wastes considerable effort collecting the information, and investors pay transactions fees acting on it. Security analysts may also be unable to translate correct facts into accurate estimates of future earnings. A faulty analysis of valid information could throw estimates of the rate of growth of earnings and dividends far wide of the mark. The second problem is that even if the information is correct and its implications for future growth are properly assessed, the analyst might make a faulty value estimate. It is virtually impossible to translate specific estimates of growth into a single estimate of intrinsic value. Indeed, attempts to obtain a measure of fundamental value may be an unrewarding search for a will-o'-the-wisp. All the information available to the security analyst may already be reflected accurately by the market. Any difference between a security's price and its value may result from an incorrect estimate of value. The final problem is that, even with correct information and value estimates, the stock you buy might still go down. For example, suppose that biodegradable bottling company is selling at 30 times earnings, and the analyst estimates that it can sustain a long-term growth rate of 25%. If, on average, stocks with 25% anticipated growth rates are selling at 40 times earnings, the fundamentalist might conclude that biodegradable was a cheap stock and recommend purchase. But suppose, a few months later, stocks with 25% growth rates are selling in the market at only 20 times earnings. Even if the analyst was correct in his growth rate estimate, his customers might not gain because the market revalued its estimates of what growth stocks were worth. The market might correct its mistake by revaluing all stocks downward, rather than raising the price for biodegradable bottling. Such changes in valuation are not extraordinary. These are the routine fluctuations in market sentiment that were experienced in the past. Not only can the average multiple change rapidly for stocks in general, but so can the premium assigned to growth. Clearly, then, one should not take the success of fundamental analysis for granted. Using fundamental and technical analysis together. Many analysts use a combination of techniques to judge whether individual stocks are attractive for purchase. One of the most sensible procedures can easily be summarized by the following three rules. The persistent, patient reader will recognize that the rules are based on principles of stock pricing I have developed above. Rule 1. Buy only companies that are expected to have above-average earnings growth for 5 or more years. An extraordinary long-run earnings growth rate is the single most important element contributing to the success of most stock investments. Google and practically all the other really outstanding common stocks of the past were growth stocks. Difficult as the job may be, picking stocks whose earnings grow is the name of the game. Consistent growth not only increases the earnings and dividends of the company, but may also increase the multiple that the market is willing to pay for those earnings. Thus, the purchaser of a stock whose earnings begin to grow rapidly has a chance at a potential double benefit. Both the earnings and the multiple may increase. Rule 2. Never pay more for a stock than its firm foundation of value. While I have argued, and I hope persuasively, that you can never judge the exact intrinsic value of a stock, many analysts feel that you can roughly gauge when a stock seems to be reasonably priced. Generally, the earnings multiple for the market as a whole is a helpful benchmark. Growth stocks selling at multiples in line with or not very much above this multiple often represent good value. There are important advantages to buying growth stocks at very reasonable earnings multiples. If your growth estimate turns out to be correct, you may get the double bonus I mentioned in connection with Rule 1. The price will tend to go up simply because the earnings went up, but also the multiple is likely to expand in recognition of the growth rate that is established, hence the double bonus. Suppose, for example, you buy a stock earning $1 per share and selling at $7.50. If the earnings grow to $2 per share, and if the price earnings multiple increases from 7.5 to 15 in recognition that the company now can be considered a growth stock, you don't just double your money, you quadruple it. That's because your $7.50 stock will be worth $30, 15, the multiple, times $2, the earnings. Now consider the other side of the coin. There are special risks involved in buying growth stocks when the market has already recognized the growth and has bid up the price-earnings multiple to a hefty premium over that accorded more run-of-the-mill stocks. The problem is that the very high multiples may already fully reflect the growth that is anticipated. And if the growth does not materialize and earnings, in fact, go down, or even grow more slowly than expected, you will take a very unpleasant bath. The double benefits that are possible if the earnings of low-multiple stocks grow can become double damages if the earnings of high-multiple stocks decline. What is proposed, then, is a strategy of buying unrecognized growth stocks whose earnings multiples are not at any substantial premium over the market. Of course, it is very hard to predict growth, but even if the growth does not materialize and earnings decline, the damage is likely to be only single if the multiple is low to begin with, whereas the benefits may double if things do turn out as you expected. This is an extra way to put the odds in your favor. Peter Lynch, the very successful but now retired manager of the Magellan Fund, used this technique to great advantage during the fund's early years. Lynch calculated each potential stock's P.E. to growth ratio, or P.E.G. ratio, and would buy for his portfolio only those stocks with high growth relative to their P.E.s. This was not simply a low P.E. strategy, because a stock with a 50% growth rate and a P.E. of 25, P.E.G. ratio of 1/2, was deemed far better than a stock with 20% growth and a P.E. of 20, P.E.G. ratio of 1. If one is correct in one's growth projections, and for a while Lynch was, this strategy can produce excellent returns. We can summarize the discussion thus far by restating the first two rules. Look for growth situations with low price earnings multiples. If the growth takes place, there's often a double bonus. Both the earnings and the multiple rise, producing large gains. Beware of very high multiple stocks in which future growth is already discounted. If growth doesn't materialize, losses are doubly heavy. Both the earnings and the multiples drop. Rule 3. Look for stocks whose stories of anticipated growth are of the kind on which investors can build castles in the air. I have stressed the importance of psychological elements in stock price determination. Individual and institutional investors are not computers that calculate warranted price earnings multiples and print out buy and sell decisions. They are emotional human beings, driven by greed, gambling instincts, hope, and fear in their stock market decisions. This is why successful investing demands both intellectual and psychological acuteness. Stocks that produce good feelings in the minds of investors can sell at premium multiples for long periods, even if the growth rate is only average. Those not so blessed may sell at low multiples for long periods, even if their growth rate is above average. To be sure, if a growth rate appears to be established, the stock is almost certain to attract some type of following. The market is not irrational, but stocks are like people. What stimulates one may leave another cold, and the multiple improvement may be smaller and slower to be realized if the story never catches on. So, Rule 3 says to ask yourself whether the story about your stock is one that is likely to catch the fancy of the crowd. Is it a story from which contagious dreams can be generated? Is it a story on which investors can build castles in the air, but castles in the air that really rest on a firm foundation? You don't have to be a technician to follow Rule 3. You might simply use your intuition or speculative sense to judge whether the story on your stock is likely to catch the fancy of the crowd, particularly the notice of institutional investors. Technical analysts, however, would look for some tangible evidence before they could be convinced that the investment idea was, in fact, catching on. This tangible evidence is, of course, the beginning of an uptrend or a technical signal that could reliably predict that an uptrend would develop. Although the rules I have outlined seem sensible, the important question is whether they really work. After all, lots of other people are playing the game, and it is by no means obvious that anyone can win consistently. In the next two chapters, I shall look at the actual record. Chapter 6 will consider the question, does technical analysis work? Chapter 7 looks at the performance record of fundamentalists. Together, they should help us evaluate how much confidence we should have in the advice of professional investment people. Chapter 6. Technical Analysis and the Random Walk Theory. From Gilbert and Sullivan, HMS Pinafore. Things are seldom what they seem. Skim milk masquerades as cream. Not earnings, nor dividends, nor risk, nor gloom of high interest rates stay the technicians from their assigned task, studying the price movements of stocks. Such single-minded devotion to numbers has yielded the most colorful theories and folk language of Wall Street. Hold the winners, sell the losers. Switch into the strong stocks. Sell this issue, it's acting poorly. Don't fight the tape. All are popular prescriptions of technical analysts. They build their strategies upon dreams of castles in the air and expect their tools to tell them which castle is being built and how to get in on the ground floor. The question is, do they work? Holes in their shoes, and ambiguity in their forecasts. University professors are sometimes asked by their students, if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? The question usually rankles professors who think of themselves as passing up worldly riches to engage in such an obviously socially useful occupation as teaching. The same question is more appropriately addressed to technicians, since the whole point of technical analysis is to make money. One would expect that those who preach it should practice it successfully. On close examination, technicians are often seen with holes in their shoes and frayed shirt collars. I personally have never known a successful technician, but I have seen the wrecks of several unsuccessful ones. Curiously, however, the broke technician is never apologetic. If you commit the social error of asking him why he is broke, he will tell you quite ingenuously that he made the all-too-human error of not believing his own charts. To my great embarrassment, I once choked conspicuously at the dinner table when a chartist made such a comment. I have since made it a rule never to eat with a chartist. It's bad for digestion. Although technicians might not get rich following their own advice, their store of words is precious indeed. Consider this advice offered by one technical service. The market's rise after a period of reaccumulation is a bullish sign. Nevertheless, fulcrum characteristics are not yet clearly present and a resistance area exists 40 points higher in the Dow, so it is clearly premature to say the next leg of the bull market is up. If, in the coming weeks, a test of the lows holds and the market breaks out of its flag, a further rise would be indicated. Should the lows be violated, a continuation of the intermediate-term downtrend is called for. In view of the current situation, it is a distinct possibility that traders will sit in the wings awaiting a clearer delineation of the trend and the market will move in a narrow trading range. If you ask me what this means, I cannot tell you. But I think the technician probably had the following in mind. If the market does not go up or go down, it will remain unchanged. Even the weather forecaster can do better than that. Obviously, I'm biased. This is not only a personal bias, but a professional one as well. Technical analysis is anathema to much of the academic world. We love to pick on it. We have two main reasons. One, after paying transactions, costs, and taxes, the method does not do better than a buy-and-hold strategy. And two, it's easy to pick on. And while it may seem a bit unfair, just remember that it's your money we're trying to save. Although the computer perhaps enhanced the standing of the technician for a time, and while charting services are widely available on the Internet, technology has ultimately proved to be the technician's undoing. Just as fast as he or she creates charts to show where the market is going, the academic gets busy constructing charts showing where the technician has been. Because it's so easy to test all the technical trading rules on the computer, it has become a favorite pastime for academics to see whether they really work. Is there momentum in the stock market? The technician believes that knowledge of a stock's past behavior can help predict its probable future behavior. In other words, the sequence of price changes before any given day is important in predicting the price change for that day. This might be called the wallpaper principle. The technical analyst tries to predict future stock prices just as we might predict that the pattern of wallpaper behind the mirror is the same as the pattern above the mirror. The basic premise is that there are repeatable patterns in space and time. Chartists believe momentum exists in the market. Supposedly, stocks that have been rising will continue to do so, and those that begin falling will go on sinking. Investors should therefore buy stocks that start rising and continue to hold their strong stocks. Should the stock begin to fall, investors are advised to sell. These technical rules have been tested exhaustively by using stock price data on the major exchanges going back as far as the beginning of the 20th century. The results reveal that past movements in stock prices cannot be used reliably to foretell future movements. The stock market has little, if any, memory. While the market does exhibit some momentum from time to time, it does not occur dependably, and there is not enough persistence in stock prices to make trend-following strategies consistently profitable. Although there is some short-term momentum in the stock market, as will be described more fully in Chapter 11, any investor who pays transactions, costs, and taxes cannot benefit from it. Economists have also examined the technician's thesis that there are often sequences of price changes in the same direction over several days, or several weeks, or months. Stocks are likened to fullbacks who, once having gained some momentum, can be expected to carry on for a long gain. It turns out that this is simply not the case. Sometimes one gets positive price changes, rising prices, for several days in a row. but sometimes when you are flipping a fair coin, you also get a long string of heads in a row, and you get sequences of positive or negative price changes no more frequently than you can expect random sequences of heads or tails in a row. What are often called persistent patterns in the stock market occur no more frequently than the runs of luck in the fortunes of any gambler. This is what economists mean when they say that stock prices behave very much like a random walk. Just what exactly is a random walk? To many people, this appears to be errant nonsense. Even the most casual reader of the financial pages can easily spot patterns in the market. The persistence of this belief in repetitive stock market patterns is due to statistical illusion. To illustrate, let me describe an experiment in which I asked my students to participate. The students were asked to construct a stock chart showing the movements of a hypothetical stock initially selling at $50. For each successive trading day, the closing stock price would be determined by the flip of a coin. If the toss was a head, the students assumed that the stock closed 0.5 point higher than the preceding close. If the flip was a tail, the price was assumed to be down by 0.5. The chart derived from random coin tossings looks remarkably like a normal stock price chart and even appears to display cycles. Of course, the pronounced cycles that we seem to observe in coin tossings do not occur at regular intervals as true cycles do, but neither do the ups and downs in the stock market. It is this lack of regularity that is crucial. The cycles in the stock charts are no more true cycles than the runs of luck or misfortune of the ordinary gambler. And the fact that stocks seem to be in an uptrend, which looks just like the upward move in some earlier period, provides no useful information on the dependability or duration of the current uptrend. Yes, history does tend to repeat itself in the stock market, but in an infinitely surprising variety of ways that confound any attempts to profit from a knowledge of past price patterns. In other simulated stock charts derived from student coin tossings, there were head and shoulders formations, triple tops and bottoms, and other more esoteric chart patterns. One chart showed a beautiful upward breakout from an inverted head and shoulders, a very bullish formation. I showed it to a chartist friend of mine, who practically jumped out of his skin. "What is this company?" he exclaimed. "We've got to buy immediately. This pattern's a classic. There's no question the stock will be up 15 points next week." He did not respond kindly when I told him the chart had been produced by flipping a coin. Chartists have no sense of humor. I got my comeuppance when Business Week hired a technician adept at hatchet work to review the first edition of this book. My students used a completely random process to produce their stock charts. With each toss, as long as the coins used were fair, there was a 50% chance of heads, implying an upward move in the price of the stock, and a 50% chance of tails and a downward move. Even if they flipped 10 heads in a row, the chance of getting a head on the next toss was still 50%. Mathematicians call a sequence of numbers produced by a random process, such as those on our simulated stock chart, a random walk. The next move on the chart is completely unpredictable on the basis of what has happened before. The stock market does not conform perfectly to the mathematician's ideal of the complete independence of present price movements from those in the past. There is some momentum in stock prices. When good news arises, investors often only partially adjust their estimates of the appropriate price of the stock. Slow adjustment can make stock prices rise steadily for a period, imparting a degree of momentum. The failure of stock prices to measure up perfectly to the definition of a random walk led the financial economists Andrew Low and A. Craig McKinley to publish a book entitled A Non-Random Walk Down Wall Street. In addition to some evidence of short-term momentum, there has been a long-run uptrend in most averages of stock prices in line with the long-run growth of earnings and dividends. But don't count on short-term momentum to give you some surefire strategy to allow you to beat the market. For one thing, stock prices don't always underreact to news. Sometimes they overreact, and price reversals can occur with terrifying suddenness. We shall see in Chapter 11 that investment funds managed in accordance with a momentum strategy, started off with subpar results. And even during periods when momentum is present, and the market fails to behave like a random walk, the systematic relationships that exist are often so small that they are not useful to investors. The transactions, charges, and taxes involved in trying to take advantage of these dependencies are far greater than any profits that might be obtained. Thus, an accurate statement of the weak form of the random walk hypothesis goes as follows. The history of stock price movements contains no useful information that will enable an investor consistently to outperform a buy-and-hold strategy in managing a portfolio. If the weak form of the random walk hypothesis is valid, then, as my colleague Richard Quant says, technical analysis is akin to astrology and every bit as scientific. I'm not saying that technical strategies never make money. They very often do make profits. The point is rather that a simple buy-and-hold strategy, that is, buying a stock or group of stocks and holding on for a long period of time, typically makes as much or more money. When scientists want to test the efficacy of some new drug, they usually run an experiment in which two groups of patients are administered pills, one containing the drug in question, the other a worthless placebo, a sugar pill. The results of the administration to the two groups are compared, and the drug is deemed effective only if the group receiving the drug did better than the group getting the placebo. Obviously, if both groups got better in the same period of time, the drug should not be given the credit, even if the patients did recover. In the stock market experiments, the placebo with which the technical strategies are compared is the buy-and-hold strategy. Technical schemes often do make profits for their users, but so does a buy-and-hold strategy. Indeed, as we shall see later, a simple buy-and-hold strategy using a portfolio consisting of all the stocks in a broad stock market index has provided investors with an average annual rate of return of about 10% over the past 80 years. Only if technical schemes produce better returns than the market can they be judged effective. To date, none has consistently passed the test. Some more elaborate technical systems. Devotees of technical analysis may argue, with some justification, that I have been unfair. The simple tests I've just described do not do justice to the richness of technical analysis. Unfortunately for the technician, even more elaborate trading rules have been subjected to scientific testing. Let's examine a few popular ones in detail. The filter system. Under the popular filter system, a stock that has reached a low and has moved up, say, 5%, or any other percent you wish to name, is said to be in an uptrend. A stock that has moved down 5% from a peak is said to be in a downtrend. You're supposed to buy any stock that has moved up 5% from its low and hold it until the price moves down 5% from a subsequent high, at which time you sell and perhaps even sell short. The short position is maintained until the price rises at least 5% from a subsequent low. This scheme is very popular with brokers. Indeed, the filter method lies behind the popular stop-loss order favored by brokers where the client is advised to sell his stock if it falls 5% below his purchase price to limit his potential losses. The argument is that presumably a stock that falls by 5% will be going into a downtrend. Exhaustive testing of various filter rules has been undertaken. The percentage drop or rise that filters out buy and sell candidates has been allowed to vary from 1% to 50%. The tests covered different time periods and involved individual stocks as well as stock indexes. The results are remarkably consistent. When the higher transactions charges incurred under the filter rules are taken into consideration, these techniques cannot consistently beat a policy of simply buying the individual stock or the stock index and holding it over the period during which the test is performed. The individual investor would do well to avoid using any filter rule and, I might add, any broker who recommends it. The Dow Theory. The Dow Theory is a great tug-of-war between resistance and support. When the market tops out and moves down, that previous peak defines a resistance area because people who missed selling at the top would be anxious to do so if given another opportunity. If the market then rises again and nears the previous peak, It is said to be testing the resistance area. Now comes the moment of truth. If the market breaks through the resistance area, it is likely to keep going up for a while and the previous resistance area becomes a support area. If, on the other hand, the market fails to penetrate the resistance area and instead falls through the preceding low where there was previous support, a bear market signal is given and the investor is advised to sell. The basic Dow principle implies a strategy of buying when the market goes higher than the last peak and selling when it sinks through the preceding valley. There are various wrinkles to the theory, but the basic idea is part of the gospel of charting. Unhappily, the signals generated by the Dow mechanism have no significance for predicting future price movements. The market's performance after sell signals is no different from its performance after buy signals. Relative to simply buying and holding the representative list of stocks in the market averages, the Dow follower actually comes out a little behind, because the strategy entails a number of extra brokerage costs as the investor buys and sells when the strategy decrees. The relative strength system. In the relative strength system, an investor buys and holds those stocks that are acting well, that is, outperforming the general market indexes. Conversely, the stocks that are acting poorly relative to the market should be avoided or perhaps even sold short. While there do seem to be some time periods when a relative strength strategy would have outperformed a buy-and-hold strategy, there is no evidence that it can do so consistently. As indicated earlier, there is some evidence of momentum in the stock market. Nevertheless, a computer test of relative strength rules over a 25-year period suggests that such rules are not, after accounting for transactions, charges, and taxes, useful for investors. Price-volume systems. Price-volume systems suggest that when a stock or the general market rises on large or increasing volume, there is an unsatisfied excess of buying interest, and the stock will continue its rise. Conversely, when a stock drops on large volume, selling pressure is indicated, and a sell signal is given. Again, the investor following such a system is likely to be disappointed in the results. The buy and sell signals generated by the strategy contain no information useful for predicting future price movements. As with all technical strategies, however, the investor is obliged to do a great deal of in-and-out trading, and thus his transactions costs and taxes are far in excess of those necessitated in a buy-and-hold strategy. After accounting for these costs, the investor does worse than he would by simply buying and holding a diversified group of stocks. Reading chart patterns. Perhaps some of the more complicated chart patterns, such as those described in the preceding chapter, are able to reveal the future course of stock prices. For example, is the downward penetration of a head and shoulders formation a reliable bearish omen? As one of the gospels of charting technical analysis puts it, one does not bring instantly to a stop a heavy car moving at 70 miles per hour and all within the same split second turn it around and get it moving back down the road in the opposite direction. Before the stock turns around, its price movements are supposed to form one of a number of extensive reversal patterns as the smart money traders slowly distribute their shares to the public. Of course, we know some stocks do reverse directions in quite a hurry. This is called an unfortunate V formation. But perhaps some chart configurations can, like the Roman soothsayers, accurately foretell the future. Alas, the computer has even tested more arcane charting techniques, and the technician's tool has again betrayed him. In one elaborate study, the computer was programmed to draw charts for 548 stocks traded on the New York Stock Exchange over a 5-year period. It was instructed to scan all the charts and identify any one of 32 of the most popularly followed chart patterns. The computer was told to be on the lookout for heads and shoulders, triple tops and bottoms, channels, wedges, diamonds, and so forth. Because the machine is a very thorough, though rather dull, worker, we can be sure that it did not miss any significant chart patterns. When the machine found that one of the bearish chart patterns, such as a head and shoulders, was followed by a downward move through the neckline toward décolletage, a most bearish omen, it recorded a sell signal. If, on the other hand, A triple bottom was followed by an upside breakout, a most favorable augury. A buy signal was recorded. The computer then followed the performance of the stocks at which buy and sell signals were given and compared them with the performance record of the general market. Again, there seemed to be no relationship between the technical signal and subsequent performance. If you had bought only those stocks with buy signals and sold on a sell signal, your performance after transactions costs would have been no better than that achieved with a buy and hold strategy. Randomness is hard to accept. Human nature likes order. People find it hard to accept the notion of randomness. No matter what the laws of chance might tell us, we search for patterns among random events whenever they might occur, not only in the stock market, but even in interpreting sporting phenomena. In describing an outstanding performance by a basketball player, reporters and spectators commonly use expressions such as, LeBron James has the hot hand, or Kobe Bryant is a streak shooter. Those who play, coach, or follow basketball are almost universally convinced that if a player has successfully made his last shot or last few shots, he is more likely to make his next shot. A study by a group of psychologists, however, suggests that the hot hand phenomenon is a myth. The psychologists did a detailed study of every shot taken by the Philadelphia 76ers over a full season and a half. They found no positive correlation between the outcomes of successive shots. Indeed, they found that a hit by a player followed by a miss was actually a bit likelier than the case of making two baskets in a row. Moreover, the researchers looked at sequences of more than two shots. Again, they found that the number of long streaks, that is, hitting of several baskets in a row, was no greater than could have been expected in a random set of data, such as flipping coins in which every event was independent of its predecessor. Although the event of making one's last two or three shots influenced the player's perception of whether he would make his next shot, the hard evidence was that there was no effect. The researchers then confirmed their study by examining the free throw records of the Boston Celtics and by conducting controlled shooting experiments with the men and women of the Cornell University varsity basketball teams. These findings do not imply that basketball is a game of chance rather than skill. Obviously, there are some players who are more adept at making baskets and free throws than others. The point is, however, that the probability of making a shot is independent of the outcome of previous shots. The psychologists conjecture that the persistent belief in the hot hand could be due to memory bias. If long sequences of hits or misses are more memorable than alternating sequences, observers are likely to overestimate the correlation between successive shots. When events sometimes do come in clusters and streaks, people refuse to believe that they are random, even though such clusters and streaks do occur frequently in random data such as are derived from the tossing of a coin. A gaggle of other technical theories to help you lose money. Once the academic world polished off most of the standard technical trading rules, it turned its august attention toward some of the more fanciful schemes. The world of financial analysis would be much quieter and duller without the Chartists, as the following techniques amply demonstrate. The hemline indicator. Not content with price movements, some technical analysts have broadened their investigations to include other movements as well. One of the most charming of these schemes has been called by the author Ira Cobley the bull markets and bare knees theory. Check the hemlines of women's dresses in any given year, and you'll have an idea of the direction of stock prices. The following chart suggests a loose tendency for bull markets to be associated with bare knees and depressed markets to be associated with bear markets for girl watchers. For example, in the late 19th century and early part of the 20th, the stock market was rather dull, and so were hemlines. But then came rising hemlines and the great bull market of the 1920s. To be followed by long skirts and the crash of the 1930s. Actually, hemlines fell in 1927 before the most dynamic phase of the bull market. Things did not work out as well in the post-World War II period. The market declined sharply during the summer of 1946, well in advance of the introduction of the new look featuring longer skirts in 1947. Similarly, the sharp stock market decline that began at the end of 1968 preceded the introduction of the miniskirt, which was high fashion in 1969 and especially in 1970. How did the theory work out during the crash of 1987? You might think the hemline indicator failed. After all, in the spring of 1987, when designers began shipping their fall lines, very short skirts were decreed as the fashion for the time. But along about the beginning of October, when the first chill winds began blowing across the country, a strange thing happened. Most women decided that miniskirts were not for them. As women went back to long skirts, designers quickly followed suit. The rest is stock market history. And how about the severe bear markets of the first decade of the 2000s? Unfortunately, you guessed it, pants became the fashion. Women business leaders and politicians always appeared in pantsuits. Now we know the real culprit for the punishing bear markets of the period. Even though there does seem to be some evidence in favor of the theory, don't be too optimistic about expecting the hemline indicator to give you a leg up on market timing. No longer are women imprisoned by the tyranny of hemlines. As Vogue put it, you can now dress like a man or woman, and all hemline lengths are now okay. I'm afraid this stock market theory has undoubtedly outlived its usefulness. The Super Bowl indicator. Why did the market go up in 2009? That's easy to answer for a technical analyst who uses the Super Bowl indicator. The Super Bowl indicator forecasts how the stock market will perform on the basis of which team wins the Super Bowl. A victory by an original member of the National Football League, such as the Steelers in 2009, predicts a bull market.